This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Dr. Greg Gilbert joins me live in studio. He is a doctor right here in Charlottesville, Virginia, and our guest this hour on Charlottesville Right Now. We have a whole lot to talk about. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
It's great to be here, Coy.
And very fitting that you're here on my return day. That's right. When I come back from being sick. And we were talking before we went on the air that, and you were saying that what I have, which wasn't the flu, I never had a fever or body aches or anything, but like everything else, is actually going around, that this is pretty common this time of year.
Unfortunately, it is. Lots of bugs out there. Not all of it's strep or flu, but most of it's nasty.
And but you know what's funny is everybody reacts like it is flu because of the media hype. You know, everybody's like, oh, no, you've got it. You've got it.
Total paranoia.
Yeah. And I'm sure you're seeing that quite a bit. People coming in the office thinking, oh, my gosh, am I going to die? I got the flu. And they don't have the flu.
A lot of what we do is reassurance.
Yeah.
That's right.
Give us a Greg Gilbert 101, little brief bio, and then we'll talk about some issues.
So thanks, Coy. I finished college at Wake Forest, and I went to work for OSHA, which is Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And so I kind of policed the chemical industry in New Jersey and tried to protect the workers from their workplace. And then I went to graduate school and got a master's in public health, and then went to work for a couple of pharmaceutical companies, kind of protecting their workers from the workplace hazards. And then went to medical school and did a residency in Greensboro, and then went out to practice in rural North Carolina in what was at that time the second poorest county in the state. And that was kind of a payback. The government paid my way through med school, paid every penny of it.
Wow.
And so I went to work in an underserved area and loved it, and probably would have stayed there, but it was not the right thing for my family. So I moved up here in 89.
In 89, okay.
And then 8 years ago, a week before 9/11, started a practice on Garrett Street, downtown.
Right. Now, I'm familiar with Western North Carolina. Allison's family's from Waynesville.
Right.
Were you around in that area?
No, I was the other side, out towards Negg's Head. Kind of the tobacco fields and swamps and cotton fields.
Yeah, it's where the Barefoots are from.
There are a lot of Barefoots there.
Yeah, oh yeah.
There are.
Very, very common down
there.
Yeah,
it is.
It's like a shiftlet down there. You know?
I went to college with some Barefoots, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. They came to Virginia actually in 1635 from southern England, and then in the 1700s moved down into that part of North Carolina because there was a lot of work down there. They were cleaning out the swamps and a lot of lumber mills and things like that.
Yeah, it's still going on.
It still is, yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us about the practice now and the vision behind the practice that you established here in Charlottesville.
So our office is really set up to serve anybody who needs health care. And regardless of ability to pay, whether they have insurance or not, or where they live. So we have a sliding fee scale, which means that if a person is in work or not working and makes minimum wage, if they do, then they can get their health care for about $20 a visit, which is the equivalent of a copay. And for those who live in the neighborhood, the housing community across the street from us, the Section 8 housing, which is Friendship Circle, Friendship Court, those folks can also come and join us. They mostly have Medicaid. And then we serve the general community and outlying areas as far as Stanton and some people in Richmond as well.
What's been the biggest thing that you think you've learned since you started the practice now, which is, I guess, going on a decade? What are some of the things you've learned? Because this is something not all doctors do. I mean, a lot of doctors say, hey, I spent a lot of time studying. I paid my dues. I'm going to make as much money as I can and charge, find the most wealthiest patients I can find.
Right. If you can afford your illness, you can come see me.
Yeah.
I've learned, first of all, that I'm not a businessman, but I kind of knew that already. But I've proven to myself, anyway, that a private company can serve the underserved and still make a living. And it represents about 10% of our practice, and we accept that as part of our service back to the community, back to the people that have helped us get started. And so we sort of balance it out. We actually could not get a loan in this town. We went to four banks, and they would not give us a loan because they said that our open-door policy would swamp us with non-paying patients, and therefore we would go under. And finally, First Citizens came up and said, we believe in what you're doing. And then Piedmont Housing Alliance came along as well. They're a nonprofit, and gave us the money that we needed to get going.
That's amazing.
So our business plan didn't look good.
But and yet you proved all those banks wrong.
We have. We have, yeah. It's kind of what I call God's formula. The more you give away, the more you receive. Yeah. So it's been great.
Now, speaking of that very theme, you also participate in a number of trips abroad involved in international medicine. What is that about?
Well, I sort of wanted to balance my life here in Virginia, in the U.S., with service overseas. And I really love going to the small rural areas, whether it's in Honduras or now I've been going to Haiti the last couple of years.
Oh, Lord.
Although Haiti is right in Port-au-Prince, which is, I'm not an urbanite, but it is right downtown. But I love to hang out with these people and serve them. They are so wonderful. They teach me so much. They are full of joy and good hearts and giving. One of the problems in Haiti is you give somebody medicine for 6 months for their blood pressure, and you come back in 6 months, and they say, well, I ran out 3 months ago. How did that happen? Well, my neighbor has high blood pressure too, and I wanted to give her some medicine, so she has and I have it. And so compliance is awful, but you know they have such good hearts.
Yeah, what an amazing story. What's the biggest thing you think that most Americans who haven't done that and may never do anything like that, what don't we know about what's happening with these people overseas?
Well, first, that I don't know if I can give one answer, but we don't need money or even food, really, to be joyful and be happy and to have good hearts. However, there are many people, more than a billion, who go to bed hungry every day. And in Port-au-Prince, it's the majority of the people who really do not have enough money to actually get one good meal a day. So we started a little foundation down there called Voisinu, which means our neighbor. And so we've been supporting a school there to make sure that the kids who go to that school get fed. So we give them one good meal a day,
yeah,
which has been great to watch.
We're talking with Dr. Greg Gelbert of Charlottesville. He's the founder of Downtown Family Health on Garrett Street. Greg, let's talk about healthcare reform.
Right.
And, you know, I'm just going to open that door. I'm wondering what you, somebody who spent their whole adult life in healthcare, in a variety of occupations, you know,
right,
not just a doctor. You're not the kind of guy who went to medical school right after college.
Right.
You're involved with pharmaceutical companies and safety in the workplace and all of these kind of things. When you're watching the news or listening to the news like the rest of us, what goes through your mind when you hear about the politics and the policy of this national discussion in which we are currently embroiled?
Well, I'm excited by it, actually. The fact that we're talking about it means that we'll probably do something towards changing it. You know, in 92 or so, when Hillary Clinton tried to get stuff going, it didn't work. And it's been a long time since we've tried. And so I really feel that something is going to happen. However, I feel like what we're going to see come through the law is going to be about 1 inch of a mile of change that we need. So that opens up a whole Pandora's box as to controversy, but I really feel that we are only going to be making a little change that we need to make a lot more.
Yeah.
But it's going to open the door. And so all the conversations, all the anger, it's a very emotional issue, obviously. Hopefully will all lead towards some degree of change. And right or wrong, it'll at least get us going, and then there'll be a lot more happening, I think, in the next couple of years.
Yeah. Now, as somebody who sees patients every day, as somebody who travels abroad and sees patients, when you say we need a lot of change, and you've probably, like many doctors, have realized this for a long time, what change do we need? What is, you know, what's your message for the average American voter out there as a physician, as a doctor, as somebody who cares for people? This is what we need yesterday.
I feel like we need to ask a few basic questions before we make any laws. And until we answer those questions as a group, as a collective, then I don't think we're going to go in the right direction. The first one is healthcare reform worthy if it doesn't include the least of us? That is, if it doesn't include children, pregnant women, and the poor, is it the right way to go? And in my belief, which is as a Christian, is that we are called to take care of the poorest. That is the God amongst us. And so if we don't
literally
serve them,
the message of Jesus Christ in the New Testament,
exactly,
you know, put it all down, your worldly treasures, follow me and care for the poor and feed the hungry.
Right, right. I mean, it's very simple, but we don't do it right now. And there's a lot of poor that go unserved. You know, they don't have any health care.
So you think if policy comes out of Washington that's just about judicial reform or how, you know, the insurance companies work, if it's not really includes the you know, the least among us,
right,
then it's not worth it.
It's not sufficient.
Yeah.
Correct. Another question is, how wealthy should one person become on the illness of a patient or of a person? What I mean is it right for the CEO of a pharmaceutical company or an insurance company or a physician to make a lot of money on sick people? And what I'm talking about is putting a cap on how much money anybody can earn. And that includes myself. So I'm not afraid to say physicians should have a cap on how much they make. To me, healthcare is more of a sacred trust. It's not a real business like the auto industry or the construction industry. It really isn't. It's too fundamental. It's too important to just say, let's throw it out there to the for-profit companies and see what happens. Because that's what's happened so far, and it's not working out very well.
Yeah, that's where we've been for a long time. That's what's developed in the 20th century is we'll just let the marketplace handle it.
Right.
And we are at a position now where, you know, it's a for-profit industry.
It truly is. And I don't think, and there's another point there, that I don't think that shareholders should dictate how we practice our health care. You know, and we all have, you know, stock in something, shares, mutual funds, whatever. And I don't think that we as citizens should be dictating the whole healthcare industry because we want more profit. Yeah. I don't think that's right.
Now, what's your response to this folks, some people out there who might be listening, and I can promise you they are, well, there's absolutely nothing wrong with the capitalist system. That is the cure for everything. And it's the cure for this. And we need profit to be a part of the situation because that's what gives us the best health care in the world.
I just don't accept that, period. I really don't. And I'm not also saying that the opposite is true, that it should be a totally government-run program, nor should it be a socialized system. I saw a woman today from London, and she had a chest x-ray done while she was in London last month, and it took her 4 weeks to get that chest x-ray. That's not right. And I'm not saying that the whole British system is wrong, but there are parts of it that are scary, and there are parts in Canada because I hear that as well. By the same token, Coy, I saw a woman today. She's 62. She broke her hip in September, 2 months ago, and she has a $44,000 bill to pay at UVA. Okay.
Oh my
now,
God.
We spent all day trying to find out what Anthem would pay them. And I can tell you that it's probably half of that, but I couldn't get an exact answer. So in other words, the poor or the people who are uninsured, this woman is not really poor, but she doesn't have insurance. The poor would pay a full price, whereas the insured person would pay about half. So is that fair? I don't think so.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about the fact that the rest of us who do have insurance, we're helping to subsidize that. And to me, that's like one of the biggest points of this whole debate that keeps getting lost and that so many people keep conveniently ignoring.
Right.
That if you have health insurance and you think you're fine and, you know, screw everybody else, you're paying for everybody else.
Well, we are. Yeah. Our premiums are pretty high. Even a healthy person like yourself and myself, we have pretty high premiums, and it's because of uninsured and it's because of some people who really do need the system dramatically and run up huge bills and $200,000 in a year. So we're also paying for them as well.
Yeah.
Right.
We're talking with Dr. Greg Gilbert of Charlottesville. And what are some of these other questions that you think that should be part of this debate?
So who do we accept as medical students? The latest discussions about this is that people are joining medicine, going into medicine because they want job security. I don't think that's the right reason to go into medicine. It's not a business. It's not a guarantee of a good salary. I mean, I don't think that that is right. I think service to humanity is probably the correct answer. So right from the very beginning, we're not accepting people all the time who really are devoted to serving their fellow man. How much should doctors give back to our society? Should they be required to take a sliding fee scale to take uninsured people? Or should they expect to go work in an underserved area, whether it's Southeast Washington, D.C., or rural Virginia? Should we expect that physicians pay back their society for the right to practice medicine? I feel like they should.
Yeah. And, you know, along those same lines, so much of this I look at as a really, I hate to put it this way, but it's a national security issue. When this country's healthy and strong, then we're strong as
we're
a
strong,
nation.
Right.
And then our ideals are strong.
Right.
And then we could set an example. And you know, those ideals travel faster around the world through example than they do at the end of a gun. I mean, history has shown that.
Right.
That is a fact.
Yeah.
More people want to adopt your ideals from the example that you set rather than being forced to.
Right.
They just want, if you go into their country with guns and tanks, they just want to fight you for being there. They don't necessarily want, you know, want your freedoms that you're trying to spread.
Right.
So
right.
I really see so much of this as the calling of this nation at this point in time to be strong, to
right.
stand up and set an example for the world and for, you know, all of those who come after us, that if we don't take care of the least among us, and you know, again, we return to the message of Jesus. We don't care the least among us. This country's in trouble.
Yeah, we are.
We're weak. I mean, we're setting ourselves up for failure.
There are actually many non-Christian countries, and I don't know that, I shouldn't say that we're a Christian country anymore, but there are many countries who are, in Europe, for example, who take care of the least. They really do insure the poor. They make sure that the children and the pregnant women are taken care of. Now, I have to say that our medical system here is the best for certain things, for very specific types of surgeries that are very tricky. We have some of the best, we have the best surgeons in the world. If I were in a car accident, I would want to be in this country because we have the best trauma centers in the world. So we have some great aspects to our medical system and then some really poor, the ones that we talked about not taking care of the least of us.
Yeah. And often preventive medicine as well is not as strong.
Is lacking.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's go
right.
to the phones. David is waiting patiently in Charlottesville on line one. David, you're on with Dr. Greg Gelbert. Go right ahead.
Hey, guys. Yeah, great topic today. The only thing I'd like to at least throw into the mix, and maybe you've talked about it because I just turned the radio on, is you talked about, you know, obviously the person who does not have health insurance is going to have to pay that full bill for her hip replacement. And someone who does would pay half, and yet, you know, those that are insured do get compensation from Anthem to pay some of that. That's why you have it. But I think the other point, too, is, you know, as doctors and as hospitals, you didn't just fall off the ship. And you certainly price your services accordingly because you know that there is a percentage of the population who is not going to pay. So for the paying customers like myself and others, even though we do have insurance, those costs are passed on to those who can pay the bill. So I think that needs to be mentioned in this discussion as well.
I agree with you, David. You're right.
It's an excellent point. That's there as well. The cost, I mean, the fact is the costs in America are astronomical compared to other nations, some of which have healthier people.
Right.
I mean, that. Yeah. It's just this. It's mind-blowing, and that is a fact. And yet people aren't talking about that. They're not acknowledging that.
Yeah.
The people on both sides of this debate. There are people in other countries with healthcare systems that may not have better trauma centers, may not have better surgeons, but generally speaking, people are healthier. And you know, they're better at taking care of themselves, and yet they pay a fraction of what we pay.
They do.
It's amazing.
Yeah, you know, administrative costs in this country, healthcare, are about 25% of the healthcare dollar. That's a huge amount of money. And for each of our little private practices, like my little business downtown, it probably is the same. It's probably at least 20%, just dealing with insurance companies and all the paperwork. Whereas you go to a country like Taiwan, and their administrative costs are 2%. 2%.
And now, how is that?
You know, I honestly don't know if it runs that well. But it certainly gives you a balance as to how much you can and how much you could spend.
Yeah.
So 2% may be a little too low, but 25% is a lot of money out of our pockets not towards healthcare, but towards administrative costs.
Yeah, well, we'd all agree with that. We're talking with Dr. Greg Gelbert about healthcare reform in America. We're also going to talk about vaccines and the swine flu as well. Our guest this hour on Charlottesville Right Now, David, thank you for the call. Excellent point. We're going to take a break here at the bottom of the hour for local news and weather. Continue this conversation on the other side. Let's rejoin our conversation with Dr. Greg Gelbert of Charlottesville. We're talking about health care reform and related subjects. Greg, you were talking before we went to a break about some of the questions that we should be asking in this debate that may or may not have been asked already and may or may not be part of the discussion. But from your experience, these are really the questions we should be asking.
Right, right. I believe that primary care is an important part of health care. And it is diminishing in size. That means the number of physicians who are obstetricians, pediatricians, psychiatrists, and family physicians and internists is dwindling. And it's primarily because...
That's all under the umbrella of primary care.
Primary care.
Okay.
It's primarily because those physicians do not make as much as the specialists do. And medical students finish medical school with as much as $200,000 in debt. And they figure... They do the math and say, you know, I think if I become an anesthesiologist, I'm going to pay that back in 3 years instead of 10 years if I become a family doctor. And so economics helps to guide good physicians away from primary care. So my own feeling is that the government should help out here and cover part of the tuition of those people who want to go into primary care so that they are no longer bound with huge debts so that they can go into practices that are not going to be as lucrative as a specialist.
And of course, when you say the government should help pay for it, that's us.
That's
our taxpayer money. So then we should expect something in return,
right?
Some community hours or something like that.
Right, right. Service.
Some volunteer service.
Right.
Which makes all the sense in the world.
It's perfect, actually, in my mind, because maybe it's only because that's what I did. You know, government paid for my education. I had no loans to pay back. I went to an underserved area for 4 years, loved it. My income during those 4 years was, let's say, about a quarter of what I could have made, but that didn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, we were having fun.
And if somebody wants to take the loans or pay for it themselves,
so be it.
That's fine. So be it. Go ahead.
Right.
But if you want the community to invest in you, you have to pay back.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And we don't have that right now, or is that
It's very small. Yeah, when I was going into med school in 78, every medical student who got accepted into school got an application and an invitation to join the National Health Service Corps, either that or the Indian Health Service Corps to work on the Indian reservation.
Yeah.
Whereas now, you have to kind of hunt and peck to find even the applications because the whole program is so small compared to what it used to be.
Interesting. And that sort of changes the experience that you have as a for your whole career. I mean, it can set the tone for your whole career.
It can set the tone.
Do you notice a generational difference between the folks who went through when you were going through in the 70s and the kids coming out of medical school today?
I do. I teach a fair number of medical students from UVA, as does my partner, Bill Maloney. And there are many who are kind of more business savvy and have chosen professions, specialties that pay better, and they'll have less debt. And they'll pay it back faster, which is, it's unfortunate for primary care because a lot of small towns don't need a specialist. They just need a doc. They just need an internist, a pediatrician, a family physician, and they're not getting it because there's not enough of those folks going out from the medical schools.
Yeah. What do you think, if you had like a list of like one, two, or three of the main things that you wanted to see in a health reform care package that may or may not be there, what can you point to say, you know, I practice medicine. I know we need one, two, and three.
Okay. I know that we need to take profit out of healthcare. That means insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies. What that means is that these groups, these corporations should be nonprofit. In other words, they should not be driven by the dollar. And that's what drives them now. There is no reason why the CEO for United Health should be making $10 to $15 million a year on salary alone. There's just no reason. That, to me, is a sin. Because he's making his money on sick people and on denying people health care coverage.
Yeah.
We spend
That's the funniest thing that I saw. The funniest part of the debate was when people were yelling. The funniest thing was when people were saying, you know, get government out of healthcare. Right. We don't need socialized medicine, when in fact we have a ton of socialized medicine already. Medicare, Medicaid,
right.
You know, the servicemen and women.
Veterans.
Yeah, right. Veterans. Right. We have a lot of it, and a lot of it runs really, really well, and it's sure. pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
Right. The other thing I thought was so funny is that they were, and my mind just went blank, but right ahead.
So that's part of it. That even hospitals should not be profitable. Now, that doesn't mean that these nonprofit companies shouldn't be monitored, because there is a big problem in Richmond in the 70s when Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is now Anthem, built this humongous building as a nonprofit, cost them lots of money, and a few books were written about this because they were misspending their money. So they do need to be monitored and you know, follow up to make sure that they're spending their money wisely and they're not overpaying their CEOs and their CFOs and so forth. So hospitals, insurance companies, and pharmaceutical companies should not be profitable in my world. Physicians should not make money on what they refer to. A study was done not long ago by the Washington Post of a urology group in Illinois where they looked at what they were doing in their practice, and they were ordering about 12 CAT scans per month out of their practice. They then bought a CAT scan. Now they're doing 30 a month. What does that tell you?
They got to pay for that machine.
They got to pay for that machine and make a profit on it. So that should be taken out of the equation, period. And then lastly, as I mentioned before, I think that we need to cover everybody. And that's not going to be cheap. But I think that people should pay for their lifestyle. In other words, if I want to go and buy a soda out of the machine, I should be paying a sin tax. 10, 20 cents on that can of soda, because that soda is sugar. It's going to contribute to heart disease, diabetes, obesity, all issues that cost us a lot of money because of the healthcare problems that they create down the road. That's part of our obesity problem. So if I want to eat a trans fat fried hamburger, so be it. Let me pay a tax on it, because what we're saying is that hamburger is going to come back and bite you in 20 years, and I'm going to be paying for your bypass. Fine, if you want to buy, you know, eat a big fat burger, go for it. But expect to pay a tax on it, because it's going to cost us as a society down the road. I think that the government should be, if they're going to pay for food stamps, for example, people should buy only healthy foods with those food stamps. Nothing makes me sicker than to walk through the grocery line and see somebody buy a box of Cap'n Crunch.
A bunch of crap with my money.
Right. It's actually Cap'n Crunch is my favorite cereal, but it's all sugar.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's no reason, for the same reason, a child in a grade school should not be fed tacos or pizza every day of the week, which is what happens in the schools.
Yeah.
That's junk food. It's not helping them. So down the road, it's going to cost the government more money, because these kids are going to get obese and have healthcare problems because they're not fed properly.
And we're all paying for it. It's sort of the idea of driving. We tell people there's a limit on how fast you can drive.
Right.
You have to wear seatbelts.
Right.
You got to have – your car has to be properly fixed, because we don't want you pumping pollution into the air. I mean, the whole idea is
exactly.
You're not alone here. What you are doing on the road is affecting my health and the well-being of me and my kids. And we already do that every day, and nobody thinks twice about it. That's just how we do it, because we recognize that we all have to use the roads.
Right.
And yet when it comes to medicine, it's like we throw that all out the window, and it's, you know, dog eat dog and screw your neighbor and, right. You know, leave me alone. I get to do what I want to do. And yet I'm paying for the fact that you're sick.
We are paying for it. Absolutely. By the same token, as I was talking before the show, Coy, you and I swim a lot. Yeah. Well, we should get some kind of a benefit from that, because we're taking care of our bodies. So anybody who takes care of themselves, who works out, buys a home equipment for their house if they live in the country, or works out in a club like we do in a city, we should get some type of refund from our health care.
Yeah.
Why not? Because we're taking care of ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, you're contributing to lower costs. And
right. Hopefully.
The CEO making some more money.
Right.
You know? And that's where it's going.
Yeah.
That's where it's going. It's not going back into healthcare. It's not going back into making people healthier in this country.
It's not.
It's going to a very few select people who just happen to have the right jobs, and they're taking all the money.
Making a lot of money.
Yeah.
On sick
and
people.
It amazes me that there's so many people in this country think that there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. that just is how it is, and because it's capitalism, well, then it must be right. Well,
right.
Slavery was capitalism too.
Yeah.
And we decided, oh, you know what? This probably isn't right.
Right.
Even though it was total capitalism.
And there's nothing wrong with capitalism, but I think it does not belong per se in healthcare. So that's where I'm going to differ with a lot of people who are, you know, maybe think that it should all be run by the free market. I don't think the free market's worked. We've had it for the last 30 or 40 years, and it's costing us a lot of money. And people are falling off the insurance wagon because they can no longer afford it.
Yeah,
you know, in the
which
ideal,
makes it more expensive for the rest of us.
Right. In the ideal world, we wouldn't need a free clinic. I love the people at the free clinic, and we need them desperately at this moment. But in the ideal world, we shouldn't need it because all people should have access to their doctor.
Yeah.
Now, the real problem for me, and I am a bit of a libertarian here. I'm not sure we can demand that every person is required in this country to buy health insurance. At the same time, this is a tough debate because at the same time, that person who chooses not to have health insurance gets hit by a car, survives it, winds up in the ER and runs up a $50,000 bill in 3 days. Who's going to pay that?
We pay it.
We pay it.
Yeah.
So that's the problem, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that's one part of the package I think the health insurance companies do want to see in there that the conservatives are working on because it would drive everybody to them. Yeah, force people to come to us. Sort of
right.
Like when the pharmaceutical companies lobby to get this new vaccine or whatever it is, vaccine of the month, on the schedule.
Right.
You know, yeah, force people by law to buy our product.
Right.
And that's basically what that is.
And that's happened as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? But before we run out of time
right.
here, I'm just curious about your thoughts as somebody who's had their career sort of span the last few decades, and you've, you know, literally watched the vaccine schedule go from just a few shots, you know, like when we were kids
right.
to now it's, you know, in the 20s,
yeah.
you know, it's
yeah.
it's astronomical. And you know, there's people like me who believe that autism is related to mercury in vaccines. Not everybody
right.
agrees with that. That's
right.
fine. But
right. Right. I think that there are some vaccines that are worthwhile. When I was a young physician, we often had kids in the hospital with meningitis caused by Haemophilus or pneumococcal, which is a bacteria. We don't have that anymore because the vaccine's been so successful. There used to be a horrible vaccine for whooping cough or pertussis, which used to make a lot of kids sick. We've now improved that. So I think that the DTaP, as it's called now, which covers diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, is a good vaccine. In my practice, I tend to recommend 3 vaccines for kids. It's just those 3. I don't give more than one at a time, usually, in the beginning anyway. None have mercury, because I do believe that there is a thimerosal connection with autism, even though the government and the studies show so far don't prove it. There's enough anecdotal evidence to me that I delay some vaccines for that reason. I don't believe in the varicella vaccine, which is chickenpox vaccine. And the reason I don't believe in it is because, number one, chickenpox is not a serious illness for the majority of people. 2, we don't know how this vaccine is going to work the rest of our lives. What's happened is the company who made it said, 1 vaccine per lifetime. At age 1, give every kid in the country the vaccine for chickenpox, and we'll have no more chickenpox. That didn't really work. Actually, kids by 5 or 6 years of age were getting chickenpox because the vaccine was wearing off. Ah, okay, so let's have a second vaccine. So we'll give a second vaccine at age 5. Well, now they're learning that these kids, as they get to be teenagers, that the immunization is wearing off. So now 15-year-olds are being suggested that they get a 3rd vaccine for varicella. Well, what is this leaning towards? What's going to happen when that child is now an adult, 25, 30, 40 years old, and that vaccine wears off? Chickenpox in an adult is a much different disease. People are much sicker from chickenpox. They wind up in the hospital a lot of times. So we are creating a system that is going to have a disaster in about 20 years. So the only solution to me is to not give the vaccine at all and let everybody, all the kids get chickenpox like you and I did when we were kids. And that's just the way it is. The other vaccines, I'm not a big fan of, like the retrovirus for diarrhea. In this country, if I were in Haiti or in Honduras, I'd say you all should get that vaccine because it kills kids. But in this country, it doesn't. I don't think there's any reason for that vaccine. The HPV vaccine, Gardasil, I think is actually a good idea. I've buried enough women with cervical cancer to know that the vaccine may work and may do well. but of course not till they're 16, 17 years old. By the same token, the hepatitis vaccine, which most kids get when they're born, I believe in that vaccine because hepatitis B is an awful disease and it's fatal in some people, but they don't need to get it till they're 16 or 17 years old when they become sexually active or you know, use IV drugs.
Yeah.
So there again, that vaccine's okay, but put it off until they're older.
What about the swine flu vaccine that's gotten so much attention recently?
So what I told, you know, the swine flu vaccine may be a good vaccine. I don't know for sure, but they certainly pushed it through very, very fast. And maybe for good reason, but when people asked me in August, September what I would do, I said wait until November, which is now, because let's see what the first 20 or 30 million vaccines do. Let's let the first 20 or 30 million people become guinea pigs and see if they do okay. If there's no horrible reaction to this vaccine, then it's probably a good idea. The unfortunate thing is that there's a real shortage. And so there have been some fatalities. I think 1,300 so far in this country.
From the vaccine?
From the swine flu. So it's not a good illness, and it does make people really sick. If the vaccine were perfect, and it may be, then it may be very protective, but I have not encouraged it until now. Another problem is Tamiflu. You know, Tamiflu is this drug to help cure or prevent H1N1 and the seasonal vaccine, seasonal flu. The problem is that my nurses spend 40 minutes on the phone with an insurance company trying to get approval or pre-authorization for Tamiflu for a patient. So we have a drug that may work, but we can't get it to the patient because their insurance company won't cover it. Problem. So I suggest people take Acillo or acylococcinum, which is a homeopathic remedy. It's been around for 100 years for the flu. It works well. It's been studied in peer-reviewed journals. It works. It's about $12 in your local CVS pharmacy or other pharmacies, and it's okay.
And what's it called again?
Acillo is the short name, O-S-C-I-L-L-O, or acylococcinum is the full name. But it's in all the pharmacies and health food stores. It's a homeopathic remedy.
Dr. Greg Gelbard, our guest this hour on Charlottesville Right Now. He's the founder of Downtown Family Health right here in Charlottesville. Greg, I've enjoyed it. Thanks for being here.
It's been great to be here, Coy. Thanks a lot for having me.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.